One. Hello, everyone. I'm Trent Luce. Welcome to another edition of Rural Route. Trying to get my programs in place here. Rural Route's a program where we gather every day at this time. And what we do is we gather, discuss the issues between rural and urban America. We do it every Monday through Friday anyway. It is Thursday. That means that Jenny Swaggart from Tremont, Illinois, has secured us yet another fascinating goat yoga mom from inner city somewhere.
Yeah, you find today, I know. Jenny? I'm getting closer, though. I mean, he does have a infant, so I'm getting closer to that two-year-old.
Does he have a goat?
Not that I am aware of. I don't think that they allow that down there, but if he was back home, I apologize to our guests. I really, truly am not concentrating on Illinois, but Vance grew up not far from where I am at. But the reason I wanted to bring Vance on is because I want to talk about being open-minded and having thoughtful reactions. We had an awesome listener or viewer reach out to us this last week, and we just had a phenomenal conversation all weekend long. And we really talked about how we all, including myself, need to be more open-minded. Vance headed up the millennial engagement for Monsanto, and I can't think of a more difficult role to be in and be able to be open-minded and help direct others to be open-minded. So everybody, welcome Vance Crowe.
Hi, Vance. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I have to tell you, and I kind of let the cat out of the bag, my first introduction to Vance Crowe and his work was interviewing some veterinarian from Minnesota named Brad Frecking. I have to say, you even made him sound like he knew what he was talking about. I've never been able to do that.
You know, that was actually a wild interview. They reached out to me to be like, hey, all this stuff is going on. And I had no idea who Brad was at the time. But once we started talking, that conversation changed the way that I approached coronavirus. So Brad was an awesome guy.
You know what Brad told me about the conversation? Trent, Vance has got a lot more toys than you. You should really look into more toys. I'm like, what are you talking about? My toys get the job done. Well, welcome to the program, man.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
I want to get to that later because he uses virtual reality and I get it a little bit, but I don't get it to the point where you're talking about you're doing interviews and things like that in virtual reality. But let's save that for a later segment. And can you start out by talking about your background? Because I do want people to understand the diversity and how our paths ended up meeting.
Yeah, so I grew up in small town central Illinois, not far from Tremont, and was one of those kids that thought the only way to live is to get as far away from home as I possibly can. And so I went away to school, and there I became a person that thought, I want to live a cosmopolitan life. So I became a deckhand on a ship after college, and then ran a camp for inner city kids. I joined the Peace Corps and went to Africa. I just did a whole bunch of different things, kind of jumping around the world, really. Ultimately, I got a graduate degree in cross-cultural negotiations and went to work at the World Bank, which a lot of people don't really know what the World Bank is, but it's a cousin to the UN. And the UN doesn't really have very much money. They make all these proclamations, and then the proclamations are carried out by the World Bank. After I got to see the inside of Washington, D.C., I decided that I hated it and that all of my dreams of living this like wild East Coast life that was so much richer than what I had back home, I realized this is all a facade. This is life is what you make of it. So I ended up meeting my wife, who was an aerospace engineer working in the defense industry at the time. And we decided to move to St. Louis so she could change careers and become a physical therapist. And when I moved to St. Louis, I had a chance to, I started my own company. And after running it for about 2 years, I had a chance to interview for this crazy job, director of millennial engagement at Monsanto. And I only took the interview because I thought, well, who doesn't want to see inside of North Korea? Because my impression, not having been from ag, was that Monsanto was pure evil. And so I thought, well, if I go do this interview, I could probably write a great blog about how I got into Willy Wonka's evil chocolate factory. And this is what I found out. And after doing a whole bunch of interviews, I eventually came to the conclusion that whoever they hired for this job, they were going to let run around the company and talk to anyone they wanted, ask anything you wanted, and then be able to go out and talk with it to the world. And I realized one of two things is going to happen if I take this job. Either I'm going to discover that they're the most evil company in the world, and I now have an inside track to write the greatest tell-all book of all time, or this is somehow a deeply misunderstood company, and that you've probably just stumbled upon maybe one of the most important problems in the history of civilization, which is we're growing food more bountifully than we ever have before, and yet people are really angry about where their food is coming from. And so I took the job and did it for 5 years and had a wild experience learning how people come to the conclusions they do, what does it take to change people's minds, and how do you keep your sanity when it feels like everyone you talk to thinks they already know who you are and they don't really like who that is.
So I can't take credit for this. This is like one of the oldest sayings on earth, Vance, but you now fully understand that a man with a full belly has many problems. A man with an empty stomach has but one.
100%. And you really don't understand just how luxurious it is to hate your food system until you've been inside of it and you realize, like, well, people don't have to know anything about it. They get to go to the grocery store, even if they despise it, and they still get to eat.
Yeah.
What was one of the most difficult conversations that you had in that role?
I think the most difficult were the first ones, which is when I went out and said, hey, all my friends from the Peace Corps, the World Bank, the university, I'm going to go work for Monsanto. And people that I knew, that I had known for 10 years, people that had stayed over in my house, that had eaten dinner with my family, all these things, now all of a sudden went from Vance is a good guy who we trust and we're on Vance's team to we hate Vance. And there's nothing he can say that will change our mind that he is not a sellout. And so you have that experience happen with people that you know really well. And it's a jarring experience because you start suddenly realize how much of your friendships can be based on political or ideology. And it's very unsettling. It really changed the nature through which I saw relationships that I had built. And I think that was a precursor to what we then later saw after the Trump election and we're living now. I just got to feel that wave before everyone else.
Yeah, you went exactly where I was going to go, because today we see people choosing not to do business with the local veterinarian or some other business entity because they had a sign for one political candidate or they were vocal for one political candidate. And if you're a Trump supporter, I can't do business with you. If you're a Biden supporter, it's like, are you stupid? You had the perfect training ground for how to deal with that. So we're all turning to you. Vance, what's the answer?
Well, I think the first thing is that it's understanding the nature of the problem. And I think that there is a concept called the intransigent minority that really snapped a lot into my mind. And the idea is, like, we kind of think that the way that culture changes is that groups of people, the large mass, decides, let's kind of change our way we're thinking and we're going to slowly move to this other way of thinking. But it turns out that's not how society or culture changes. What happens is society is just going along with whatever is in front of them. And then there's a small group of people that believe something so fervently that they will not accept any other answer. And so you could take the example of kosher, for example. Somebody that eats kosher that says, I will not eat any other food. They make the demand of eating kosher. And other people, they're like, well, if the food here is kosher, it doesn't really matter to me. So if we want to make everything kosher, that's fine. But now you've just moved the line over for now all the food has to be labeled as kosher to be able to satisfy that group of people. Well, that goes on with basically everything. A small group of people make a decision that they will not accept any other solution. And for the most part, people don't want to fight. And so they give in. And then we just keep inching and inching further towards a different direction of the way that culture should think about things.
And then there's that other group of people that say, kosher? No, I don't like pickles anyway. And my point is that they're just so out of tune that they just exist every day without somebody interfering with their life.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the big things that rural has a challenge understanding about urban is that in rural, if you don't really like the way that people are behaving or what's going on, you can kind of navigate it. Everybody has to kind of get along. In the urban environment, if you get around people that you don't like, you can just throw that group of people away. There's 100 more people right in front of you. So you don't have to work out those issues. So in my opinion, the intransigent minority has a lot more authority and power in high density locations, because you can just keep pushing and pushing and pushing and not get pushed out of society yourself.
That was Vance Crowe saying that if you don't like your friends, you can just dispose of them if you live in the city, not Trent or Jenny. We have to take a break. Lone Creek Cattle Company is providing the opportunity to add more value. No, you're adding the value. You're capturing the value by getting paid better for the calves that you produce because they're sired by the Piedmontese bulls from Lone Creek, and they possess the myostatin gene, something that Jennifer Grimes cannot brag about with her Red Angus cattle. Get more details about how you can be a part of Lone Creek Cattle Company's certified Piedmontese system by contacting Marlon Will at lonecreekcattleco.com. We're back with more Roll Route after this. Jennifer was throwing a little Red Angus plug in here for her Red Angus in Denton, Texas, so I had to harass her a bit.
Okay, so we do not have very many people on. I shared on Twitter, shared on Facebook.
I got a message at the both of the start of across the pond and across the pond and on this at the beginning that Facebook was not sharing our broadcast today. But clearly it is, because that's where Jennifer and Tyler are watching, and I got a plethora of other people. But yeah, Facebook's playing. I think they're censoring people. I don't know. I couldn't be for sure.
Maybe you think.
Back in 3, 2, 1. Welcome back. Roll Route, Trent Luce, alongside Jenny Swaggart every Thursday, bringing us a soccer mom, except this one. Vance Crowe, welcome. You did mention that your wife was an aerospace engineer.
Yeah.
This week, the first this week in history, by the way, I think it was 82 or 3 maybe, the first woman piloted a spaceship. First female. Yeah, it was this week. So my question is, do you let her drive your car?
My wife is the most aggressive driver in the world. In fact, when we moved from Washington, D.C. to St. Louis, I had to be like, now, Ann, in D.C., you can cut people off, you can flip them the bird, you can yell at them, and you're not going to see them again. But in St. Louis, you're going to see those people maybe by the time you park your car, so you've got to knock this off. So we had to have like a come to Jesus moment of you've got to change how you're driving.
Did it work?
I still prefer to drive.
Enough said.
No, we'll just leave it at that. I see we have most of the regulars on here, so we're okay. Good to go.
Good. Yeah. Good. So that's a big jump going from aerospace to physical therapy. What initiated that?
It isn't. It's all mechanics. It's either the mechanics of the ship or the mechanics of the human body.
It actually, you're exactly right. It's physics. Yeah. The way that she saw it is it's physics through fluid, right? So the human body is moving through water or through air. And so her love was physics, and she really disliked the bureaucratic structure. Like a lot of people don't realize this. Most engineers that are employed in, say, something like the defense industry or the aerospace industry are not actually getting to do engineering. They're going to meetings all day. They're in design reviews that go on for years. And so she was basically saying, I want to do engineering. I want to be applying what I understand about mathematics and how things move. And I want to do it every single day. And physical therapy brought her a lot closer to being a real engineer than the situation she was in aerospace.
I can see
physics
that.
Through fluid. I'm so stealing that. That's really good. Hey, do you want to go to my picture?
Yes, let's do that.
Yeah, because I just was intrigued. You know, every day I kind of look at what's going on in history. And this is a picture of Winston Churchill, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Joseph Stalin sitting. I don't know who the guys are standing behind. But that picture was taken on February the 4th, this day in 1945, as these three individuals gather to talk about bringing World War II to an end. It just intrigued me to no end for several reasons. Number one, we just had, 1.5 million people die in the World War II. These guys look like they're having a good time. But the thing that intrigued me the most, if you look at Winston Churchill, there is a huge lit cigar in his fingers. Franklin D. Roosevelt has a cigarette between those first two fingers, and it's about half smoked. I was intrigued by how this meeting is taking place, and these guys are taking a picture. Stalin, by the way, has no smoking apparatus whatsoever. Am I making a mountain out of a molehill, Vance, here, or what do you see in that picture?
Well, I see in this picture what very few people foresaw, which was that about anywhere between 20 to 60 million were about to be killed by the guy on the right. And the impact that his life had on the rest of the world, and the fact that most people, if you went to ask any high school kid, any college kid, not only who is Joseph Stalin, but what happened after this photo was taken, they would have literally no idea, and they really wouldn't understand the impact that Stalin had on the farmers of Russia, which was the first group of people that he rounded up and started pushing off into Gulag. So I see Stalin, I see that picture as one of the greatest omens of our time, that things can go from bad to unimaginably bad very, very quickly within the matter of a few months after that photo was taken.
Yeah, and it's worth illustrating. You said that he took the farmers and incarcerated them. Stalin did not kill people by putting them in a concentration camp and gunning them down at gunpoint. He starved them to death.
And when you go look at the just the sadistic behavior of that, when people used to go around, peasants, and glean the fields, they would go out and pick up seeds. Right. If you were found out to be gleaning things, seeds that had been passed over by the harvest and saving them for your family, you could get 5 years in the gulags up in Siberia. So you'd have mothers that were trying to feed their starving children called out as being traitors of the country because they were stealing food. It was so beyond comprehension of our modern minds, but I think probably one of the most important things for us to understand, because we're not different people than we were in that photo.
No. And the other thing that would be really interesting to learn is, what did people know at the time? So today we're talking about censorship, and we have everybody commenting on some level of censorship taking place. I have to believe that the press wasn't real forthright with what was happening in Russia at the time in the late 40s.
Well, if you go back and read the New York Times, they were strong supporters of it. I mean, the whole concept of a Potemkin village was where the Russians would put up a little village. The New York Times would come visit. Look how pleasant it is here. Look how well this whole system is working. But that's all been washed out of history. And I think that it was washed out of our history books, right? You don't read about what happened in Soviet Russia during this time period. And so it's very difficult to learn lessons you don't teach.
Ironically, we've not heard much about Russia and COVID either in the last year. It's been one of the most underreported countries out there.
Well, so there's an interesting thing. The Russians, at the same time that they were building up their space forces, they were just crushing us when they were putting orbits, the integral up into orbit many, many times over. They were also working on vaccines. And it turns out the Russians have an exceptional vaccine program. And their vaccine right now has 91% efficacy. So it is actually more efficient than both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, which I originally thought very poorly of. I thought, wow, this is probably just propaganda. But I've actually seen people running tests on it outside of Russia that are saying they actually have quite effective vaccine development in a totally different path than the mRNA stuff that we did in the US.
Will other societies ever have access to that, do you think?
Well, the word on the street is they developed it and have such a robust program because they have to ward off so many diseases that come up through the southern border of China. So I would imagine they have a real incentive to get whatever vaccine works into places like Mongolia, into southeastern Europe, because all of those people interact with their people. So my sense is they will probably keep it close to home, but that makes a lot of sense for what they're trying to do.
You bring up a great point, Vance, that even myself never give a lot of thought to. We're an island, and it takes a little bit of work. I mean, it takes a really good passenger pigeon to get a virus from China to here, and it happens, obviously. Russia borders them on a big chunk of their border, and that's just like next door.
Yeah, and we have this concept of the U.S. and Canada as the largest unprotected border, and that's true in some sense, but the Russians, there's no possible way they could keep that entire border fenced off from all of these people that move and flow, and they've been peasants for hundreds of years in those areas, so they have a whole different way of looking at borders and how do people get in and out of different villages, so it's a different situation than what we have here.
Vance, I probably don't have time to ask this question, and I'm thinking about it because Jim Mauger says that Pfizer and Moderna reportedly that they're 94% effective. How do you suggest that we start sorting fact from fiction with the information highway?
I don't know. You know, I had the impression.
That's the wrong answer. I need you to give me the solution. What's the equation?
I think the equation is to find people you don't agree with and steel man their ideas. So that it's very important that you expose yourself to ideas that you don't agree with and find out what is the part of this idea that they feel so strongly about that I should learn something from. But that's difficult to do in today's day and age.
Oh, and you learned that from your Monsanto introduction, did you not?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's the premise of what Rural Route, We the People, has become now. So Vance is kind of an introductory training for more diverse voices that we will hear hopefully in the next few months.
Yeah, except he said that we find people we disagree with, which I agree with completely. He's yet to say something I can argue with him on or steal from him.
So I have a game that I like to play with people, and I call it the Peter Thiel paradox. And the Peter Thiel paradox is,
I think you have to be really, really careful when you say the Peter Thiel paradox. And I'm going to allow you to say that when we come back right after we take a break. The second segment is complete Neogen. We're talking about the myostatin gene. We determine what genomics are present, and you get that done through Neogen. It shines a light on your genetic future. We talk a lot about efficiency, and we talk about how we have moved into producing more with less and doing it like nobody ever saw before. In fact, Vance was talking about the efficiencies that we've accumulated and feeding more people with fewer resources. It's because we can look at those genomics and the genomics from eating qualities to disease resistance, what alleles are present, and what's going to be passed to the next generation. That is exactly what Neogen does. And ironically, they also can tell you what country your pet originated from. Crazy. You don't eat your pet unless you're hungry. Details on shining a light in your genetic future at Neogen.com. Second half of Rural Route right after this.
You know what I love about ag commercials? They treat the audience intelligently. Like you would never, ever put an ad like that out to just like a broad audience. But the fact that you can talk about alleles, and I think it's really fantastic. I think it's while ag gets kind of painted as slower than the average Joe, you listen to their ads and most human beings couldn't even understand what was being said there.
I'm not sure I understand it, but I can convey it. Back in 3, 2, 1. Welcome back to Rural Route. Trent Luce, Vance Crow, who is, by the way, breaking rules, wasting good stuff during the break. Jenny Swigert, on the other hand, she's been very obedient today.
Thank you.
Yeah. Alleos. We're looking at your alleos, Vance. We want to see. You know, you said something during the break that I want to expand upon because I think it may be the most important decision that we could. Yeah, Brian's sharing. You're breaking rules, Vance. The overall image of agriculture, because you clearly stated you did not grow up in agriculture on a farm.
Yeah, I mean, I would go out and bale hay and walk beans, but it didn't. It had no connection between that and food. I barely understood it.
You baled small square bales?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Back in the day when kids would actually work for $3 an hour?
I was always good money. Like, you're making $5 an hour. Now you can sock that money away and buy cigarettes, and you're in high hog heaven.
Yeah, just like FDR. So how do we fix the image?
Of ag?
Yes.
You know, This is such an interesting question. I like, one of the biggest challenges is that the rural and urban move at different paces, and the urban just cannot understand how quickly norms and rules and cultural concepts can change because they're moving so much slower. There's an interesting place called the Santa Fe Institute, and they did this study on how cities form. And what they figured out is you can actually time how fast people walk down the street, 100 meters. And based on how fast those groups of people are walking, you can predict how dense the city is within 10,000 people. The more dense it is, the faster people walk. And this goes all the way up to millions and millions of people. It keeps getting faster and faster walking. But in the rural areas, they're not, right? And what their theory is that ideas move much faster when you have so many more people to ping off of. And in these less dense areas like agriculture, ideas move slower. These two different paces are irreconcilable. You can't make people that are moving slower try and keep up with this pace. And I think that divide is compounding and compounding. And how you slow that down, I don't know.
Now, is that a study just of U.S. or worldwide?
Worldwide. It's worldwide. All the way through Japan, Russia, all these countries.
So that obviously leads to the perception that the smaller the town, the more rural the area, the slower they walk, the fewer good ideas they have, which creates that image of more of a simpleton instead of your hip and in the urban setting where things move fast and you come up with all the great ideas.
Well, you could say that, but also ideologies spread faster, bad ideas spread faster, concepts that you would think, hey, maybe we should see if this actually fits. As we bring this idea online, do people want to absorb it? Does it help us? And so you have a positive feedback loop can be, you know, really, really beneficial, or it can cause that feedback in your ears where your eardrums are blown out because the microphone and speaker are just talking over and over and over and over again to one another. So I don't think we should imply that ideas are better because they move faster. They're just moving faster.
And there's a lot of time. I mean, I spend so much time just watching the sheep, especially this time of year as they're getting ready to land. And, you know, my brain gets going and turning. And people in urban areas, I don't think, have that luxury to just sit and tune out the rest of the world.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. I think one of the things that people don't realize is that propaganda works because you are exposed to the same idea from different angles over and over and over and over again. And so people in the cities are exposed to vastly more propaganda. Mm-hmm. And when I say propaganda, I mean any information that somebody wants you to believe. Doesn't have to have a political bent. They're just seeing it over and over and over again. So it's much easier for them to think, not only this is what I should believe, but this is what everyone else in the entire world believes, because that's they're caught in that echo chamber in a way that ag doesn't, which is why you see so many more independent thinkers. It's why you see people not adapting to these new ideas that are being pushed out there. That's why that divide, in my opinion, happens.
This seems very basic, but just the biggest difference is people who walk slower see more. And when you go to a city, and if you get on a subway, you could be standing from me to here to a person that won't look you in the eye. And it's happening now on airplanes, by the way, too. And I drive 11 miles to town, and you wave at every car you meet. I mean, that's just the polar opposites in explaining what's really going on in terms of feeling comfortable with the surroundings.
I think there's also different dynamics between countries. When a good friend of mine and I were in Switzerland, Lucerne, she wanted to take a coffee to go. And the barista was, oh, you silly American, sit, enjoy. Because we don't sit and enjoy our coffee.
Right.
And that's a cultural, you know, from our country, I think, not necessarily, I apologize for the dogs, not necessarily because of who we are or what part of culture we come from.
You know, your listeners might find this idea called Game B somewhat interesting. So a group of people got together and they said, the speed with which urban environments are moving is actually not conducive to being a human being. Like you said, Jenny, they don't have time to think. And so it's a group of people living in the city trying to figure out, how do we not turn this into a back to the land movement where somebody with a trust fund buys a bunch of land and turns it into a commune? But really, how can you remove yourself from that fast pace and be a part of a much smaller community where you're sharing childcare, you're sharing food production, you're sharing these things? And my commentary to them when I was speaking with the one of the leaders of their group, a guy named Jim Rutt, was, how many farmers do you have engaged in this? And he was like, we're totally open to them, but we don't have very many. So I think this this place that you're trying to talk about, where it's the divide between those two, is a thing that people can look up called Game B. They might find very interesting.
Did you mean to be talking about Bill Gates, or was it just an accident?
That's what I was thinking too.
I don't think Bill Gates is involved with this project. What did I say something like that?
Bill Gates now owns 342,000 acres of farmland. I happen to have the assessor's report for the farmland in my neighboring county. You might find it interesting, by the way, he sold two of those parcels to an outfit that's managed out of Savoy, Illinois, but he now owns land in 20,000 acres just in Nebraska. In 19 states, he owns land. So I'm thinking you thought he was going to turn that into a large commune.
I think he knows the land, you know, it's all where you can harvest solar energy. And that's what the farmers have, is access to being able to harvest terawatts of power that come from the sky.
I don't know if there's a connection, but Savoy is Howie Buffett territory.
Really? Mm-hmm. Who's a farmer in Illinois as well, we might add. Warren yes. Buffett's son.
Yes.
Huh. I didn't put that tie together. It's Hancock Insurance Company that owns that and manages it. And they have an office.
There may not be a connection.
Yeah, but that is an interesting geographical location, knowing that Warren Buffett and Bill Gates are very close friends.
They are. Yes.
I continue to find rabbit holes to research in this regard. But Vance, it's like we just shared something that you were not in tune with. And that's an interesting thing. It's not a bad thing. It's just interesting because people in farm country for the last, well, since Forbes magazine came out with the article, what, 3 weeks ago?
Yeah.
Everybody's like, what's Bill Gates doing with all this farmland?
Yeah. It's been a sore spot.
And it wasn't on your radar, Vance, until we brought it up.
Yeah, I had heard of it vaguely, but it was not something that had a big impact on me. I was kind of like, well, isn't that obvious? Isn't that if I was, you know, uber wealthy, what would I do? I would definitely buy land.
Which leads me into where I thought we would go in this last segment, but maybe we'll go there a little earlier. Your involvement with the World Bank. What's your perception of, there are people legitimately buying silver because they think the value of cash is going to crash. The credit system is going to crash. You're in tune with that world. What do you see happening globally with finances?
Well, Trent, this may be a little bit edgy, but I think that, first of all, I think anybody that knows how inflation works has to say we've dumped $6 trillion and then we did it again into the financial system. The value of the paper is going to buy less. Physical goods like silver or gold, I think in some regard are probably like a decent thing to have. They are a limited resource, and you could say there, if you want silver, there's only so much of it, and it requires so much work in order to be able to get it that it's worth this much. But I think the future is actually cryptographic currency. I am a long proponent of Bitcoin, which may surprise some people, but I think it actually has many, many applications in agriculture. And I think it's deeply important for people to understand how digital currency will work, because it will be the only hedge that you have to get out of the financial system as people decide, instead of taxing our population, we're just going to print money and inflate their money.
Yeah, I've got a serious, serious problem with printing money and pulling money, more money into circulation. No economist tells you that's the way to go, and yet we continue to have both parties want to do that. That's beside the point. The Bitcoin and the digital currency, can you kind of create in a minute and a half a visual of how that's going to work and how different it is? Is it different than just having a credit card and you don't actually handle money?
By the time it gets to consumers, when it becomes ubiquitous, you won't even really be able to tell. But the sense about Bitcoin that people should understand is there is a limited finite amount of them. There's 22 million of them that will ever be put into circulation, and no one can ever go in and turn those on. So the value in it is its own scarcity. And then the fact that you have to have a collection of computers spread around the world, decentralized, that say who owns what Bitcoins, and they all have to agree. The reason this is so important is it means there's no one group of people that control how many there are out there. How does it get printed? How does it get shared around the world? And it's instead done algorithmically. I think there are definitely downsides. You have to trust the algorithms in a way that's that you have to trust the Fed right now. But I think that I think the way that it will play out is it will be much more secure than having your credit card out there, and that people will begin to see the dangers of using the old financial system in a digital world, and that this is a new digital system that's adapted to the modern age.
Yeah, and that's obviously where we're going to go when we come back, is the security of it. Because if I had Ben Franklin's and could go dig a hole and put them somewhere, somebody'd have to know where to go look to dig them up, right? If yeah. something is digital, some hacker is going to figure out how to security breach and find my dug hole. That's where we'll pick it up when we come back with the last segment. That fast, we're already into the final segment. I just want to remind you that The Stand at Paxson County is on Netflix. It is a depiction of what's taking place even in rural counties that walk slower than the faster counties. The Stand at Paxson County is based on a true story. I'm estimating 80% of what you see in that movie is actually true. 20% is Hollywood creative license. I strongly encourage you to take some time in this cold, cold winter weekend and watch The Stand at Paxson County on Netflix. You'll have more questions. I'll know if you watched it. More Vance Crowe, Jamie Swaggart, Trent Luce after this. Back. Whoa, look at the silence. 3, 2. By the way, Jennifer Grimes has a $50 endorsement for your Red Angus that I put up there. I'll be sending you a Bitcoin in the mail to pay for it. Bye. 3, 2, 1. Welcome back to Rural Route. Trent Luce into the final segment. Vance Crowe, what took you so long to get here? It's a great discussion.
Well, I turned him down for an interview. And so then I was like, okay, if I ask him for an interview, then I have to accept his interview. And so yeah. that's where, but we had to have him on because we have to, I mean, your mind is incredible.
Trent, I've got a good question for you. I think you'll like this. It was the Peter Thiel paradox that I was mentioning before. So
I completely strayed you from the Peter Thiel paradox.
Yeah. So the Peter Thiel paradox is a question to figure out: how deep is your gravity well? How many do you have any ideas that are different than the people around you? And so the question is, what is one thing that you believe is true that almost no one agrees with you on? And the reason it's a paradox is if you say something we already agree with, then you failed. But then if you say something we haven't agreed with, now you have to explain yourself. And I think if you're asking yourself that question and you say, I don't have one, then it means that your ideas are all the same as the people around you. So to put you on the spot, Trent, what is your Peter Thiel paradox?
Well, ironically, my career in media for the last 20 years, I found myself trying to find my one thing that I believe that nobody, I went to Malheur National Wildlife Refuge and I was telling people what I saw and they would argue with me. I went to the Standing Rock Pipestone protest. I would tell people what I saw and they would argue with me, and given time, and I tell people what I see taking place with our presidential election and people would argue with me. So I've kind of made a career out of finding that one thing that nobody believes to be true, and then giving enough time, being resilient enough for it to come to fruition. So you're right in my wheelhouse in that. That's what I love. I love to be the only guy trying to convince something, trying to convince you of something that you don't think could possibly be true. And the more you disagree with me, the more I want to have that conversation.
But I'm going to bring something up. So after last week's episode, one of our great viewers had agreed with you and thought that you had interpreted that I was a Biden supporter. Mm-hmm. And that was a bad thing. And I'm not, but what if I am?
you're an American, you can choose that right. But what I was confused about is you did give the clear indication that you were in that particular segment.
I didn't say I was. I said that there are lots of people mm-hmm. that I know who are Biden supporters. And I said that.
Well, you do live in Illinois.
I do, yes. Oh,
one of three states that actually voted for Biden.
I'm in a red county, though. But I gave one example of why the health care that has been offered by Democrats is beneficial to my health. That was just one example.
Right.
But you never answered my question when I asked you.
Which is?
Emailing. I said, what if I was a Biden supporter?
Oh, I didn't see that question.
Would you keep me on here?
Oh, no, I'd be more excited. I'd probably have you on two times a week.
I was just wondering.
Trying to figure out what could mislead you so badly.
You know, what did I say a few weeks ago? I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. I'm an American. And then the very wise Jeff Donald said, you know what? We're human first before we are Americans.
Absolutely.
And I think that we all forget that. And so, Jeff, if you're watching or listening, thank you for that.
I will take your question one step farther, Vance. I've had friends that have been telling me about this child trafficking thing, and we continue to see bits and pieces of it. And I started doing media because I wanted to tell the story of agriculture. I wanted people to understand who, where, and how their food is produced. Kind of like you were talking about earlier, and that everybody's angry with their food system, but they don't realize how good they have it. You know, it's Kip Thom on this program last week, who I see you interviewed as well. But Kip reminds us that in 1920, with the population of 2 billion people on the planet, 80% were food insecure. In 2020, we have 8 billion people on the planet, and less than 10% are food insecure. How is that a bad thing? How did we screw up the food system so bad? We haven't. People don't know that. But I'll be honest with you, February the 4th, 2021, I don't put agriculture and understanding at the top of the list. I see 42 million babies being aborted each year in the world. I see kids going through horrific conditions in child and sex trafficking. And I don't see how you can, if you're truly in agriculture because you support and love life, which is what it's about, how can you stand by and not try to do something to help these lives that are being diminished? Because as Jenny just stated, we're all human first. And that's first and foremost to me.
My sense is that agriculture, because it moves at that slower pace, the wisdom that comes, so tradition is wisdom that we don't always know what question we're answering, but because we're doing this thing over and over again, it has some resonance. And it's like our ancestors taught us these things. And even if we don't know the specifics about them, we still live them out. And I think in the city, so much of that tradition is walloped over by people going so fast that I don't think they're bad. I think that when they have these ideas that are new, they're so exposed to them that they don't even stop to say, what is it that our ancestors realized about the sanctity of life or the sanctity of our families or these communities that we should preserve? But I think this is a natural tendency. This was going on in Rome. I'm sure this has gone on in China. There's always a push to go faster. And there's always a push to say, remember the ancient wisdom that we had over time. And I think ag is much more in touch with that ancient wisdom. And you just have to be careful not to let ancient wisdom become a tyranny in saying you can't change.
You know, what I took from that, and it's something that what I've tried to do is insert myself in as many animal rights groups and thought processes as I possibly can. And they always come back to, well, you kill animals. You know, I remind them that everything lives, everything dies, and death with a purpose gives full meaning to life. And I live by that. And I think that what you just said speaks volumes in that those of us in agriculture, we understand life and we understand death and we understand how fragile it all is. And if you're raising a wheat crop, one hailstorm can kill your wheat crop. If you're raising pigs, one PRRS virus can kill every pig you own. And so we understand life, but we also respect death greater than the people who are completely disconnected from it. And I think that speaks to the culture that you, that's what I came to my mind as you're walking through that from a historical perspective.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the speed with which people are living their lives, I think in a lot of ways is trying to avoid the reality that we all have to face is that we will die. You know, memento mori, remember you will die. And I think agriculture is confronted with that every single day. You take the life of an animal, you recognize your own mortality. And people living in the city, you know, it was just the other day, I run a network where people get together. And for the first time, I saw somebody slaughter a cow all the way from start to finish. I'd never seen that before the other night. Now imagine people living in the city. They've eaten hundreds of pounds of beef and have never seen a cow be slaughtered or have any connection with that. They're not going to learn the wisdom that comes from slaughtering an animal if they've never seen it before.
That's exactly why I have on this phone videos of the entire process and I need to sit down and get that produced and done now.
One of the major small walkers in Central Illinois is in his hometown. And
who? What is your hometown?
I grew up in Eureka, Illinois.
Oh, Eureka. Too close to Pekin. So back to something that I wanted to just get to, because Kelly Hutchins asked a question. We were talking about Bitcoin. And I want to get back to the security, just so you know, Vance, we have 3 minutes. While we talk about walking slower in rural America and enjoying life and liking cash better than credit cards or even checks, it seems as though the Bitcoin is going to make everything faster. And if that's the case, how do you give us that assurance that the security can be there?
Well, I would say nobody should take anybody else's assurance on the security of Bitcoin. The way that you will become fascinated with it is when you understand what does it mean to be 256 SHA encryption. Like when you actually understand how encryption works.
I didn't even know what you said, let alone understand what you did.
So it's a way of understanding why it's going to be extremely difficult for those to be hacked. And when you see it, when I first understood how Bitcoin was secured structurally different than every other internet protocol, than your bank's website, it was like seeing the universe. It was a sense of awe. And no one can give that to you unless you go and understand it for yourself. And so I think nobody should take my opinion on Bitcoin. What they should do is say, I'm curious enough to go spend the time it is to learn how to do this. Because when you do, you may have the experience that I had where I went from this is a facade to this is something that I will benefit deeply from understanding and not just believing what other people tell me about it.
And now I have to get this question in, even though I don't have time. So much of the U.S., I mean, 97% of the world lives somewhere other than the U.S. And yet we're the breadbasket of the world. We have the ability to produce food unlike any other country with the infrastructure that we have, not the resources, the infrastructure. And our challenge or our opportunity is the value of the dollar. What I'm hearing you say that everybody's currency is going to be the same. How will you leverage yourself against Brazil to sell soybeans to China? It's as an example.
I think that Bitcoin will be more like an architecture, a structure that other things will be built on. And in fact, Bitcoin is not a great currency for you to do day-to-day purchases, right? If you go to make a transaction, it takes 10 minutes at a minimum for that transaction to clear, to make sure that all the computers all around the world agree with you. So this is going to be what everything is built on. It's not going to be the thing that you use day to day.
Interesting. Jenny, we have 45 seconds.
Well, I think right before that, what Vance said is, you know, that's what the biggest takeaway from today is curiosity. And don't trust our word for whatever the topic is. Go out there and find out yourself. Do the hard work, find out what the facts are, and then make a decision for yourself.
Vance, you get the profound parting wisdom of the day.
Man, keep going. Keep going. I love what you guys are doing here, and I love that you guys are trying to find people that you disagree with. Trent, I think you have a great pace. Jenny, this is great. I think what you're doing is the only way. It's to continue to collide with people that you both agree with and disagree with and explore it and let people talk. You are on, like, you are doing the Lord's work, and I mean that.
Well, we would prefer to be doing it around a table, but in the meantime, we'll let Mark Zuckerberg make it happen. By the way, it was on this day in 2004 that he launched Facebook, believe it or not, just a mere 17 years ago. We have successfully journeyed down the road connecting rural and urban America for another day. Vance Crowe, Jenny Swaggart, Trent Luce, all three of us remind you that all roads do lead to a rural route. Now we know, with a smaller pace. Small, a slower pace.